I have to have API keys. Like, how do I do that? This is something I've done in the past. It sucks. So we basically have decided all the things that are wrong with API keys in general, like how they make the market difficult. We've basically tried to solve them upfront and as quickly as possible.
Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey everyone, our guest today is James Perkins. James is a co-founder of Unkey, which is an open source API key management solution. We're really excited about to talk about that today. James, you had also previously worked at Clerk, which is kind of sort of seems to be booming in popularity. I hear about it like relatively often these days. So that's a user management service is sort of how it terms styles itself. But James, it's great to have you on. Before we sort of dig in, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners about yourself?
Yeah, not really. My name is James. I also run a YouTube channel where I do like tutorials and talk about tech in general. Super excited to be here. Can't wait to chat about Unkey and everything else.
Cool. So before we get to Unkey, I think it'd be good to like set up your journey to Unkey, because I think it's pretty interesting how started as like a full-time side project and then moved to your full-time. So at Clerk, what did you do? And if you could fill our users in a little bit more about what Clerk is, could you do that?
Yeah, for sure. So Clerk is a complete user management tool. So imagine, you know, you need to add like a login page where you need like social logins or email and password, or maybe just email. Clerk does that. And essentially the way that Clerk is kind of different from everyone else is they just give you React components that you can just drop in on your page, and that's it, you're done. Login page. While I was there, I did a variety of things. So I originally started as their DevRel. When I first was hired, I knew Colin and Braden for a while. I did some contract work for them. And then over time, you know, with every startup, your job kind of transforms into a bunch of different jobs. So I did DevRel for a while. I was the running docs as well and support all at the same time. And when I left sort of the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks, I was doing developer success, which was essentially support plus like product feedback loops through different channels. But yeah, that was my role at Clerk, and I had a really good time there. And probably still the best authentication product out there. And I would, if you haven't checked it out, definitely worth doing.
Clerk reminds me a lot of Stripe from the model of like how it approaches like providing APIs and interfaces. I mean, it's one thing that I think Stripe has done really well over time is it's like, you know what, we're just going to give you a checkout page or give you the components to build a checkout form or whatever. And I think that is a pretty nice model.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look through the history of Clerk, like they started as like a Ruby package, like all the way back, it was like a Ruby gem. And then like they realized that nobody wanted that. So like maybe we should change to something else. And they realized that front end devs just don't know how to do this. If you haven't been in the industry long enough, you've just been doing like React for the last few years, you just don't know how authentication really works behind the scenes. So they tried to make it as easy and as fast as possible, similar to Stripe, where it's like, yeah, here's just the bits that you need and make it work for your business needs. And if you need business, you know, things like organizations and teams and things like that, we can provide that. Or if you just need B2C stuff, here's a couple of drop-in components and you're done.
Yeah, especially with auth, it's like the worst thing that it's like, it's a thing I have to implement and fully understand and fully get right. And if I don't, there's like drastic, like business ending consequences. So it's like, that's the solution I would want to go for, is like something that's just like, I plop it right in and it just works and I don't have to care what's going on in the black box.
Yep, exactly. And that's why they saw such an incredible boom. I think, you know, when I joined, it was sort of kind of starting to pick up a little bit. And now, you know, if you just go to tech Twitter, it's talked about daily by somebody, whether it's like, this is my top tech stack or whatever, or like, I just use Clerk for the first time. And it's very much getting into that like Vercel almost level of like people talking about it now, where, you know, oh, I deployed to Vercel for the first time and it took 2 minutes. Like, it's in that vein now. And it's super exciting to see the growth that they've had.
Yeah, so Unkey started as a sort of a side project during that time. What sort of led to that thought I mean, as I was reading sort of some of the docs, I was like thinking about like API key management. It's just an interesting problem to tackle. So I was like curious, what were the struggles that you were seeing initially?
Yeah, so I didn't come up with the idea. So my co-founder, Andreas, actually sort of pitched it to me, but not really. So he had implemented this on a couple of side projects over, you know, the last few years, where it's like, I need to give an API as a service. Okay, now I have to have API keys. Like, how do I do that? And then you implement it one time and it's kind of rough, but then you're like, oh, it works, whatever. You kind of ignore it and you move on. And then you did another side project and the same thing happened again. It's, oh, I need it again. Let me copy and paste it from here into this project. Let me make some changes, kind of go from there. And we had been friends for a while. He works at Upstash. And so we'd been talking back and forth about a few things. And he pitched it to me and I was like, I'm in. This is something I've done in the past. You know, I've been in this industry for a long time. It sucks. Let's build this the right way. And the bigger issues that really come up when you think about key management is, one, rate limiting. How do you handle that? Like, you have to decide whether it's going to be the API is rate limited or is it every key is rate limited. And the benefits and of having per key rate limiting means that if, you know, you, Justin, suddenly get this big spike in traffic, we can bump you and not worry about bringing down the entire API platform. We just know that, oh, Justin's fine. He's got like a little bit extra in his rate limit today. And then, you know, or you become an enterprise customer and you need more, you can give that just to that specific like customer. So we thought about that for a while. And then the next issue that comes up is, how do you distribute this across the globe? Edge is super popular today, right? So everyone wants everything on the edge because then it's super fast, but it's only as fast as where you're getting the data from. So if I'm in Germany, for example, and my data center is in the US, it doesn't really matter if I'm on the edge, because you still got to go all the way to the US and back. There's a big latency there and that sucks, right? And with API keys, you want the request and verification to be almost instantaneous to your end user. You want it to be tens of milliseconds, not hundreds of milliseconds. So we figured out a way to essentially globally distribute all of these keys. And it's basically in 36 regions right now. So if you're in Germany or if you're in Asia or if you're in the US, you should see the same speeds regardless. And then comes with that is like, how do you decide on rate limiting, right? So with rate limiting again, you, if you're globally distributing, you have to make a decision consciously about things like, well, do I really care if it's exact on my rate limits? If it's not exact, that's fine. So we have two types of rate limiting. One is that it actually goes all the way to a database and verifies that that's actually the rate limit. And then we have this thing called fast rate limiting, which is basically almost a sliding scale, which is done all in memory. So assuming the user's always coming from the same region, that rate limit should be accurate. But in the case where someone was doing like a burst or something, it may not be accurate, but it's under a few milliseconds before we catch up and we can rate limit the user. And then, yeah, it's just adding things on top of layering on top of API keys. Like, what else could you have? Well, what about keys that expire today? Like, I want to give you a free trial. It's 1 week, but I don't want to have to chase you and figure out how to disable that one key or remember which key I've given you, because you shouldn't be storing the API keys in plain text anywhere. So like, how do you do that kind of stuff? So we introduced a way to essentially just say, on this date, it'll expire. And after that, the user can no longer access the product. And then the last kind of feature that we really have that's big is in the same kind of vein, which is AI with like token-based requests, right? So you could say to your user, pays you, let's say $10, and they get 100 API requests. With Unkey, you can essentially say like, this key only has 100 requests, and after that, shut it off. And the only way that they can do it again is by paying you, and you can update that key and give them more requests. So we basically have decided all the things that are wrong with API keys in general, like how they make the market difficult. We've basically tried to solve them upfront and as quickly as possible.
That's pretty cool. It reminds me a lot of Clerk itself, where it's like taking a hard, like maybe on the surface, like simple problem. Oh, I want API keys. But then it's like all that stuff you talked about, you're not going to think about that upfront. You're not going to think about like, global. You're not going to think about like temporary keys and all these things. So it just makes sense that like, oh, managed service makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that we found is that every time we've done it personally, you always think about that thing after you've done the implementation. You're like, oh, someone's complaining they got really slow latency. Well, yeah, obviously, because I'm in the US East 1 and they're all the way out in Europe. Like, how do I fix that? So we just decided, let's do it right the first time and let people just manage it, just kind of similar to Clark.
That's really cool. I mean, I think one of the challenges of all of these like products that like provide you a really solid front end, so API key management or user management or whatever, is there's also, there's always like this downstream effect of like, okay, now I need to integrate it into my stack in some meaningful way. And like API keys in particular are interesting because they have like this security ramification. It reminds me of like GitHub and how GitHub's API keys or their personal access tokens have sort of expanded over time. Originally, they had these like really coarse scopes, and it's just like very broad. And you're like, I want to like get more detailed here. And now, they do have these more like sort of granular access tokens, which in my opinion could still use a little bit of love, but they're definitely better than they were. So have y'all thought a lot about that, or is a lot of that on the user and their implementation and how it bridges?
So we have definitely thought about this. It's actually what we're working on right now, which is essentially what we're going to give you is almost Zanzibar style permissioning. And if you're not sure about the Zanzibar model, basically it's like the catch-all of any type of permissioning. So you could do role-based, or you could do access-based, or you can do a mix of both. And it's very easy to understand. It's like human readable. And we feel the same way, where you could give a key with a policy to say, Justin can read and write, but Andrew, sorry, you can only read. Like, we'll be able to handle some of that for you. The way we handle it today is we give you a free form metadata field. So if you already have that kind of implemented somewhere else, maybe in your user auth or something, you can put that directly in the metadata and we'll return it to you as part of the key verification. So it's there available so you can read it and play with it and do what you need to. But yeah, we're working on Zanzibar style model right now. And we should have that pretty soon.
That seems like a pretty big, like, kind of like scope increase from just API keys now to like user access management.
Yeah, so unfortunately, they kind of go hand in hand. Very similar in the authentication space. Like, at some point, authorization has to play a part. Now, whether you use another managed service to do that or whatever, but similarly with API keys, we just know that there's going to be somebody out there that needs that use case of like, I need to be able to differentiate between read keys, write keys, read and write keys, all those kinds of things. And we just want to make it, clickable, essentially. So you just say, like, I want this user to be able to do this, this, and this, and I'm done. And then you just give them the key and off they go, all through the API. And we just think that's the next thing that people really need. And we're willing to build out this giant model that's going to take a while for us to really build. But once you get it, the DX will just be second to none and you won't have to worry.
Yeah, I mean, that is an important part of the whole thing. And there's this interesting thing is I feel like the downstream implications of any system, like, building API keys as a feature or just thinking about authorization layer, they're rather complicated, sort of by necessity. And also, having at least being able to provide good opinions downstream, even if you're not the one enforcing those opinions, I feel like is a tremendous value add just from the perspective of like, take a company again, like GitHub being just amazing organization. And like, I see their REST API as like one of the best REST APIs sort of ever built. This is like not perfect, of course, but it's like a good model of like how to build a solid REST API. And the note that it took them a while to sort of improve tokens, and I'm sure there's a lot of reasons for that, but I could see where Unkey could provide a lot of value out of the box. It's like, hey, here's how we think you should define your scopes and I don't know, make resources available to your API or whatever.
Yeah, and I think it goes, if you've already got that system in somewhere else, so maybe you've just got your users that are already part of some org or whatever that has those teams and stuff, you can, because of the way that our like REST API works, essentially you can already have access to your user data wherever. So if you already know all of these details, you can just insert them into this key, and then you never have to worry about, is the user logged in? Can I get this permission somewhere else? Do I have to figure out who this owner is before I can do these checks and balances? And we just know that, you know, at some point, yeah, you may not use our Zanzibar style model. Maybe you'll just do your own, and that we give you the ability to do that. And we definitely just want to give you the best advice, and then you can run with it and use us, or you can delve in and do your own permissioning somewhere else.
This week's episode is unsponsored. If you'd like to sponsor DevTools FM, head over to devtools.fm/sponsor. There you can see the various ways you can advertise with DevTools FM, whether it be 1 to 10 episodes. We would like to take this time to advertise our newsletter. In the newsletter, you get a weekly breakdown of all the cool things happening in the developer tooling world, as well as a little post-episode recap of our thoughts about the episode that we released that week. It also serves as a good reminder that we released something. And of course, don't forget about our shop. If you head over to shop.devtools.fm, you can buy some DevTools FM merch. We have some cool stuff. We recently added a TypeScript tee in a bunch of different colors. It also comes in a tank top now. Or my personal favorite thing, a DevTools FM bomber jacket. I've been wearing that bomber jacket to every conference that I go to. It comes in black and has the DevTools FM logo in gray. And if you haven't subscribed to us on the platform you're listening to us on, please go ahead and do. A review wouldn't hurt either, or a comment, depending on where you are. And with that, let's get back to the episode. So we mentioned it a little bit, but you started working on Unkey while you were still at Clerk. And I think I and many of our listeners know that doing two programming jobs at once is a lot of work. So how did that go?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's not for the faint-hearted, that's for sure. I think the only good things that came, really, the only good things is that both Andreas and I were super passionate about the project from the get-go. And once we had implemented the first, like, you know, production deployment that went out and people started signing up, and we saw the growth go from 0 to like 100 essentially in a week, that showed to us that what we were building was actually something people needed. And then two, it's like, okay, how do we figure out how to divide our time in a way that made sense? And I'm very fortunate that Andreas is in Germany and I'm in the US now. So essentially, Andreas would finish his day at my lunchtime, and then he would start working on Unkey, and then I would finish my day and he would be going to bed. So there was always somebody sort of working on the project. And then on the weekends, we would just collaborate as much as possible, because that was the time where we were pretty dedicated. I was super fortunate, like my spouse, 10 out of 10, like couldn't have asked for a more support system. And she definitely encouraged me to, you know, go out and seek this the way it is. And I don't think I would have been able to do it without her and her support, because yeah, we were, you know, taking meetings and talking to people and getting feedback and bug fixing at like 10 PM at night. And, you know, all those crazy things that come along with like deploying a production product. And my wife never said anything about like, yo, can you put your laptop down for 5 minutes and like come and help me with X or Y? She was just there and super supportive. So I couldn't ask for anything better than that.
Yeah, that's great. And an incredible benefit to that time for sure. Something that's like super necessary. You know, it's one of the things that we have to make these explicit trade-offs when we're trying to sort of build these projects up. It's just like you do sacrifice time, and you know, glad you had the support for that. So when you were working on it initially, was this just the like open source side of it? Were y'all really just trying to figure out like, okay, what is the sort of basic shape of this? Or were y'all actually just like thinking about how you build out the business and like going deeper than that?
Yeah, so when we talked about the project, we knew that everything was going to be open source from the minute we talked about the project, but we knew there was a commercial viable product here. So the business has always been there in the back of our minds, and how we can, one, make it accessible for anyone to use, right? So like if you don't want to use the cloud service and you want to do everything yourself, self-host and worry about that, right? We wanted to make it as easy as possible to essentially remove the pieces you don't need. So like if you don't need Stripe because you're using it internally, you don't need Stripe, you can just throw an environment variable in there that says like Stripe false, and that will just disable all the Stripe stuff. Or if you don't want to use TinyBird for analytics, which is what we're using behind the scenes to provide all the key and API analytics, you can just turn that off and you can use your own. And we knew that we wanted to make it commercial, so the business piece was always there. But yeah, right from the get-go, it was like, okay, how do we make this sellable as a cloud product, but also we want to make sure that we're, you know, providing this easy to access open source project.
So to kind of draw the lines, is like the open source project just the way to like manage keys, and then the paid thing is like that distributed at the edge and fully managed for you?
Yeah, so that's essentially it. So you could take what is in our open source project today and deploy exactly how we are in production today as a managed service. But yeah, the managed service essentially is, you know, we manage everything from the analytics to, you know, user management, everything. Everything's on the edge, globally distributed, all that stuff is there. You could choose not to globally distribute and just have it one location and you'd be fine. But yeah, that's basically the managed service is all of the bells and whistles.
At what point did it really crystallize to you? It's like, okay, this is the thing, like I need to, you know, leave the job that I'm currently doing and like really hone in and focus on this.
Yeah, that was a really difficult thing in general. So there was definitely a tipping point where we realized that this is a thing, and potentially this thing could be a full-time business. And the tipping point for me, I think, really was the point where we had VCs just knocking at the door. Like, we would get 3 to 10 emails a day from VCs across the globe being like, what are you doing? Are you raising funds? Because we could be interested, you know, that started to happen a lot. And then, yeah, I just think that plus having so much passion for the project itself and always having this kind of founding mentality of like, even at Clerk, I treated Clerk as if I had founded Clerk. Like, I was a very early person in the thing, and I'd been there since the early days when they had really horrible React components. And so I was always invested in it. So I would work godly hours for them too, in the beginning, where we were trying to get the traction going. And I slowly saw myself being like, I'm less worried about Clerk now, and I'm more worried about the success of Unki. And that's when the sort of bell curve started to happen for me. It was a difficult decision. I never really, you know, that we're all still friends in the grand scheme of things. Like, there's no hard feelings on both sides, but it was just very much like a, if I don't do this now, I don't think I would, I think the project would just die on the grapevine, essentially, because we just can't keep doing what we're doing every day.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at a certain point, you really have to say, am I going to give enough fuel for this thing to turn into a real fire, or am I going to just, like, you know, keep it as a side project? And also, I feel like it's really hard to sort of like give any one product enough attention to make it good when you're focused across like many things like that, you know?
Yeah, you definitely get spread too thin. And I was talking to Andrew before we start recording about how, like, I do YouTube, but that gate, I had to give that up. Like, I didn't record a video for like 35 days. There was just a period I was just like, I don't have anything left in this tank to give you a YouTube video. And it was the first time I'd ever taken that much time off of YouTube since I began my YouTube channel. And you're right, like, there's only so much you can give to a product. And like, YouTube to me is like another product in my like business, right? And I just felt it was unfair to not go and challenge myself and be like, okay, let's do this. Like, if we go and do this full time and we can get funding, then the worst thing that happens is we try, we fail, and, you know, it's open source forever, and we'll maintain it as a side project. But yeah, for sure, like, there's only so much you can give, and I think there's only so much you can take away from family or friends or relationships in general. And you definitely don't want to give those up in favor of business, in my opinion.
Yeah, I found the same thing. Even in high school, it's like, I can do like maybe two things full time. Mm-hmm. Back then it was like school and a sport. If I do a third thing, my life is just like lost, and yep. I have no energy for anything.
Yeah, and that's how I felt. Like, you know, it would be the weekend and I'd be working on Unki, sort of like, you know, just the laptop on the lap, just kind of sitting around doing stuff. And I'd prefer to be going, you know, go out with my wife and go and do something, or like, you know, maybe there's some chores around the house that need to be done that I've just been ignoring because I just don't have the like the capacity to go and do it. And yeah, it was definitely getting to that point where I was like, oh, I'm burnt out. I'm more than burnt out at this point. Like, I'm a crisp, essentially, at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, massive respect for being able to pull it through and make the decision to really focus. I mean, because especially at the point where you're already feeling burnout, I know that, or I can imagine that that was just pretty hard too, because, you know, there's this, even after you like say, okay, well, I'm gonna like put down this one job and really focus full time, there is still this like, okay, now there's a mountain to climb, you know, it's just like that's where the work begins. And it, you know, can be hard to sort of manage recovery while you're like really doubling down and focused. Did you find like after you decided to go full time, were you able to like instill a little bit more balance, or was it like really heads down just to try to, you know, catch up or whatever you felt like you
Yeah,
needed to do?
it worked out very well. So, like Andres is still full time in his role. So right now it's like a part time and a full timer, and the benefit now is that I can work 15 hours in a day if I want to, but also I can just work a regular 8 hours and just be like, okay, I've done a hard shift today. Like I've been focused. We've done a bunch of stuff. We've really good. Done a few releases, whatever, and I can just walk away. And there's no guilt because before when I was doing it part time and doing Clerk full time, right? You'd finish like I'd start at 7 and finish at 4, and then I'd be like, okay, I need like 10 minutes. And then the guilt would start in the back of my mind of like, well, shit, if we don't do X or Y tonight, it's not going to get done till tomorrow. And then, like, oh, what if a customer's waiting for this? Or, you know, like those things start to trickle into the back of your mind, and then it starts to play that mental fatigue even more. But now, yeah, like I feel great right now. You know, it's only been a couple of weeks since I really made this full-time switch. But like, yeah, I feel that if I leave at the end of the day and I go and like, you know, do something outside, like no one's going to be like messaging me and be like, holy shit, we need to do these 10 things. Like those 10 things have been done. So we're like getting to do that now, versus having to spend all that time kind of worried about that in the back of my mind.
So, like Clerk, Unkey kind of has like many front ends. In the case of Unkey, you have lots of different SDKs. So, what platforms do you guys support, and like which ones are you like most excited about?
Yeah, so from like a code standpoint, we support TypeScript, Rust, Elixir, Go, Python, all the big sort of backend we have available. And some of those come from the community, right? So the joy of open source is the community wants the help, and if the language doesn't exist in the language, they'll build it because they need it for their own projects. So we have a lot of that. But the yeah, so we're most excited about TypeScript and Go really, because that's basically the entire platform's built on those two things. And yeah, those two excite us a lot. But the benefit is our REST API is really, really good. It's well documented. It's really easy to work with. So even if we don't support a language that maybe you know you want, the ability to just tap into that REST API and only having a few endpoints and all those endpoints kind of work the same way, makes it really, really easy. But yeah, TypeScript's always something I'm excited about. Go is something we're always excited about because most of it's built in either one of those, and those are pretty popular in today's world.
One that just jumps out to me that's like different from all the others on your in your docs is Nuxt. Did that one come from a community member?
Yeah, it came from Daniel. He's a, yeah, of course. Who else is it gonna come from, right? Yeah, he's a friend of ours. He hopped in and was like, hey, like, love to just build like a wrapper for Nuxt. And I think he was the first SDK that was community driven. I think it was either him or we have a community member that did Python. It was either one of those, and it was very, very quick.
That man is an elemental force in open source. It is crazy at this point.
Yeah, he just appears out of nowhere and he's like, hey, I did this thing for you guys, and then like disappears, and then you're just like, thanks. And then yeah, if you ever need anything from him, you just ping him and he's like, yep, I'm on it. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced he's not a machine learning
Yeah, I
model.
agree. I agree.
So, obviously, with a product like this, security is really important. I mean, this is, you know, the way that you're securing access to your API. So could you talk a little bit about your security posturing, how you sort of think about these things, and sort of how you communicate it to customers?
Yeah, so security is super important for, you know, everything and everyone. It was one of our main things that we were concerned about. So the first thing we did was, if you just go to our docs, like we tell you exactly how we deal with security, which is basically in two ways. We don't store the API keys. We just store a hash of that key. So, you know, And then that's stored in the database. So there's no real way, like if we ever were compromised, there's no way for us to essentially give those details out. And then like for like, the other part of that is that if you use our front end product, if you create like a, say a root key, which is a way to create resources in our product, we show that to you one time and you can never see it again. So there's no way for someone to just like, you know, socially log in, figure out, or, you know, you leave your laptop open and you've got Unkey open. There's no way for them to just go and grab a key and be like, oh, I've got your keys now. And then just like off they go. And so those things are treated pretty heavily where we are. And we do a lot of, you know, audits around how that's working. And we give you analytics on your resource keys too. So if all of a sudden you're like, man, somebody's been like, this one person seems to be accessing our, and I don't remember like them paying or whatever, you can go and look at your root key and say, okay, I only have one root key. Let me go and look at the details of it. You can see every request, where it came from, where it was, you know, like where the request originated from, where we processed that request, what the IP address was. We have all that data for you. So we can just give it to you and say, hey, by the way, like we found this. So even if you had some sort of weird anomaly in your API, you can go and look either whether it's just a key that's acting a bit strange and you're like, well, this person suddenly is doing 100,000 requests and they weren't yesterday. Why are they suddenly spiked? You can see that and you can look and see, and we tell you, you know, if we've rate limited them or whatever, all that stuff comes with it. So yeah, we're very conscious about that. And then obviously we do the standard kind of stuff, like in environments and like local environments, like no one really has access to anything outside of, you know, what keys they're supposed to have for what environment. We try and keep that pretty locked down. And then we use Clerk. So then all our user data is stored. So yeah. So we have that as well. So like, you know, if even if you are a user, like that'll never be compromised. We don't store any kind of actual real user data anywhere because we just use Clerk. So we don't have to worry about like accidentally leaking emails or things like that. That those things don't exist either.
Do you guys have any like monitoring in place? So like if that person does, like you see a key go to 100K, you can be like, oh, get an email?
Yeah. So we have a lot of monitoring, mostly because, you know, we're like on the critical path. So if something goes down, breaks, or like we get a huge spike in traffic, we need to know right now. So we use Discord for pretty much everything. So we have Axiom with monitoring set up and then some other features in there. So if anything happens, like we get big spikes or, for example, you know, we get two or three errors in a row, we'll flag that. And then it's responsibility of whoever's awake to go and look and see what's going on. And that's caught a few things, to be honest. There's been a couple of times where like one of our machines has gone down and we haven't realized because, you know, it just hasn't been used. And then suddenly someone goes to use it because they're in that area and we get an error and then we reroute their traffic somewhere else. And that's really helped too. But yeah, we monitor everything. And to be honest, because we're in such a growth stage, like the dashboard is currently on my other screen right now and it just refreshes every like, you know, 3 or 5 minutes. And I'm like, ooh, little spike, little dopamine hit as someone else uses the product. So yeah, it's pretty well watched.
That's fun. So, I mean, it sounds like you're, you know, still pretty early in this journey. You've like implemented some pretty critical features. You're working on the sort of Zanzibar-like authorization system, which would be really cool. Do you have like other ideas for features that you're wanting to implement down the road? Something you're really excited about?
Yeah. So after we finish that, or potentially at the same time, we may do them in parallel. They may end up just working together, is that we want to build out essentially a gateway product in a similar vein. So usually with API management, you start with a small basic product and then it kind of grows out. And at the end, you end up in gateways. Just the way it works. Like if you look in the industry, that you always end up there. And we're super excited about that. We think that we can do globally distributed gateways, which is something that really doesn't exist in the industry. If you go and look at big players, like Tyke is a good example. They claim that they're globally distributed. They're not. They like kind of replicate some data around and you can only do a specific amount of regions and things like that. So we think we can still do the same model we have today, but globally distribute your gateways too. So it'll be just as fast, mission critical. And we have a POC that we've done a couple times. And yeah, it just works. Like what we have right now just works. We just, you know, we've got to implement a lot of security features and things that come along with that. And yeah, we're super excited about it. We think it will be a refreshing change for, again, similar idea of like front-end devs or devs that have never done this kind of work before. Instead of having to rely on an entire team to set up a gateway, a couple of clicks, and I'm done. Okay, cool, great. I can like move on. And that's kind of what we're aiming for.
So as one of those front-end developers myself that mainly does design systems and apps, I have no clue what an API gateway is. So what is it, and like, why would I want to use one?
Yeah, so basically it's like a way for it sits between like your client and service. So imagine it's just like this piece in the middle, and that basically gets to decide where the traffic goes, who it goes to, are they allowed to access that route? It's essentially like just like a big routing table that tells everywhere where it can go and how many times they could access it. And, you know, based upon permissions, could you actually read, write, get this data back, all that kind of stuff. And essentially you end up doing that because you have an API system of some nature or services that need to talk to each other and all that kind of area. And you need to do it at scale, and you need to essentially put it in place and then have the data around where everything is happening. And it usually you don't get one until you scale to X, and then all of a sudden you realize you need one. It's like one of those things you don't really think about, and then it's too late. You need one already, and like, you know, then you're scrambling around trying to figure out who can give it to you the quickest and who can give it to you with the feature that you need. And yeah, it's essentially our key system will be like a gateway drug into gateways. You'll get to a scale point where you realize that issuing keys all the time is just not going to work anymore, and you'd rather just stick this in front of it and deal with the traffic that way. And then the advantage of that is those keys will still work with the gateway. So you'll still be able to use those keys in conjunction.
Yeah. A pattern I've seen in like front end tools a lot is like especially with like, you could look at like just rendering websites. We attack things from the front end and then like work our way back. And I see Unkey kind of doing the same thing, where it's like the front end of all of this is your API key. And you're starting from a place of like nice DX and like good user experience, and working your way back to the more complex features. Whereas like, I think solutions of old probably did the opposite, and we're like, oh, we're an API gateway first, and then we added on API keys and they kind of suck.
Yeah, and that's what we've seen. So when we first were talking about gateways, we spent a lot of time trying to sign up for gateways, whether they were open source gateways or just like, you know, they gave you a free tier and you could try it out and stuff like that. And they always touted things like, oh, we have API keys, or like you can issue keys. And then you start to use it and you're like, how do I do this? I don't understand. And then two, when you finally got it working, it just was that like, oh yeah, you can tell this was tagged on as like or we can sell this to enterprise users and then we won't have to worry about it. And the biggest thing we saw with gateways was that you literally needed a PhD to just get it to work. We were like, if we're struggling and this is the industry that we're in, there's something wrong here. And then layer on top of that, you want to like distribute it maybe in two locations. Then you need a second PhD to figure out how that all communicates together. And yeah, it was rough. It was really, really bad. And we just looked at it and went, we can do that. And we can do it better. We can make it easier and accessible.
Yeah, I think overall, I like this trend of like really focusing on the early user story, really focusing on like, you know, going from the usability side of this, like, and going deeper into the technical thing. I feel like it like does put a really good angle on it, and ends up, because it's like, there's always this challenge of, and I see this dichotomy in a lot of places. It's like, there are different mindsets in engineering. And if you have like a really deep systems mindset, you are used to a certain level of pain. That I think that users coming at it from a different perspective, like, are usually not great. So if you have someone who has a deep systems mindset, and I don't mean to like be reductive here, of course, there are many people and this is a generalization, but sometimes you can have like worse APIs that end up coming out of that, because it's just like the sort of methodologies and thought processes of how they think about building these things. So it's just different, you know, they have different mindset or whatever. And it's totally fine, but you know, we're getting to the age where like UX is so critical and it's so competitive now too, where if like the UX and DX isn't really good, people are just like, nah, don't want it, you know? So
yeah, and I think we've seen that more and more probably since, you know, Vercel actually became Vercel, you know, because they were Z at one point and now, and like when they did that changeover and they started to push this mentality of like, yeah, you could go to AWS and do all of this, or you could just come to us and give us the GitHub repo and we'll just do it for you. That methodology then sprouted a bunch of different services, you know, like Render, and you know, people started moving away from Heroku because they decided they were better than everyone else. And, you know, like these mentality shifts started to happen, and, you know, even Auth went that way. Like your option was like Auth zero. That was it. That was your big option for a really, really long time. And when you look at it now, you think, wow, like you really, it's not the best DX, not the best UX, not the best experience. But at the time, it was the only DX and UX that you could get that didn't involve you doing it all yourself. And now, yeah, there's this new generation of developers out there that are like, yeah, I don't want to think about this. I just want it to work. And then when it works, I don't want to think about it again. And, you know, 15 years ago when I started, that didn't exist. It was just like, oh, good luck. Slog it out on your own, buddy. And good luck. Hopefully there's some package out there that might do what you need to. But now, yeah, there's definitely this new age of developers out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So now we're moving on to more future-y questions.
Well, before we do, I have one like thing to maybe round off this section. So a lot of Unkey is open source. All of it is open source, ostensibly. Yeah, which is great. We're huge proponents of open source, and we talk to a lot of people who are building businesses off of open source. But it can be a non-trivial thing. So, you know, there's some definite trade-offs that you make. There are some definite advantages. So how are y'all thinking about this journey of like building an open source product and really trying to monetize it? Like, what are the principles you're putting in place to sort of make it viable, and sort of what are the challenges you think you're facing and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I think with any open source project in general, there's this idea of like, oh, with open source comes this like ultimate power of the community, right? So there's this like idea, but they're also the worst enemy, which is the community can be really mean and harsh and unreasonable, right? And so we've kind of taken the approach of similar, you know, commercial open source software out there like cow.com, where we try and be open and honest about everything. And we kind of have this like idea of, while yes, we understand that you're going to run into issues and we're going to have to fix them, and yes, you could do it yourself by opening a PR or whatever, we want to make it as easy as possible to understand the direction of the company and like where we're actually going as a viable product. And then secondarily is that when you come and open an issue, whether it's through support, through Discord, through GitHub, whatever it might be, is that there's a clear understanding of like, we have it be open source, and you could look and fix it yourself if it's something that maybe you feel like you can do yourself, but there's no onus there that just because we're open source, we expect the community to fix our problems. And so those things together kind of build out this philosophy of like, everything we do is as open as possible. Like we try and make it as easy as possible for you to understand where we're at, what we're building, what we're releasing, what we're doing. And then like also on the flip side of that is that, yeah, as a commercial product, it's very hard to be open and honest about every single thing that's happening behind the scenes. There's like stuff that happens that you probably don't need to know about. And we're just trying to emulate cal.com and similar, where we try and make everything open. So not just the source code, but the commercial offering itself is open, in the sense that, you know, we when we start, you know, we have money, we raise funds, we do all those kinds of things, we'll open that up and you'll be able to see that. You know, we're not hiding pretty much anything. We build everything in public. So, you know, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll see constant updates of like, hey, by the way, like, you know, we 2x'd our amount of verifications last month. And then like, you know, in 2 days, I'll do another one where we 5x'd or whatever the number is. And we just try and keep it as open as we can. And cal.com is like the gold standard that a lot of people kind of push towards. And we're moving in the same direction. It's going to take us a while to do like manifestos and things like that. But we just believe that, you know, if you're open and honest, most people will trust the product. And then from the community itself, like, we'll trust you to help us and guide us along the way.
So it's a great perspective. And I did not know cal.com was fully open source. That is pretty cool. I just went to their website, scrolled to the bottom, and they have a GitHub link right there.
Yeah. So they're completely open source, and you can look at, you know, how much everyone gets paid there. You can look at all those stats, how much they've raised, who they raised from, every employee that works there, like everything for them is open. So there's no hiding what they're doing behind the scenes. And I think it's a fantastic model. And I think the team over there should be incredibly proud of how they've handled this open commercial viable products. And I think, you know, if more people kind of go that trend, and we're seeing it more and more these days, I think it will lean to a better place and a better, like, you know, software in general.
Okay, so yeah, now moving on to like more future-y questions. One question I've been liking to ask all the developers that come on is, what's your spiciest dev take?
I don't know if it's the spiciest dev take, but I've always had the... So, you know, I think I've ruffled enough feathers in the industry that I still think that like people are upset about it. But anyway, I think, you know, if you use a good authentication management product, you don't need a users table. I've been a proponent of that. For a while, I've ruffled a lot of feathers. I just think it's, if the product you're using is good enough, then why even bother redundantly storing user data on your own? And I don't work at Clerk anymore, so people can't just be like, oh, it's because you work at Clerk. No, I believe it. I think it's one of these things that, like, yeah, you can get rid of that users table, get a good authentication product if you're not doing it yourself through third-party libraries, and just free up that table and figure a better way to link everything together. It's not overly spicy. Well, it is, but it's not. But yeah, that's definitely one of my spiciest ones.
It's a good take. I like doing less work.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's less work. And, you know, two, it just makes it easier for you to be like, okay, well, I know they have a unique ID in my authentication product. I'll just use that as my identifier across my database tables. All right. Now I don't have like an additional table that I have to like keep up to date. And if I need to add and, you know, or remove fields, like, I have to figure out how to migrate that. Like, all that goes away. I think, you know, I started a whole Twitter war about it, and I really got caught up in that, and it was fun. But yeah, like, I think, you know, I think it's still viable today.
I definitely do think one of the hardest problems we face generally, which is such a simple seeming problem, is like having two data sources representing the same entity can get tricky, you know? They always go out of sync.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a valid argument that people come up with, which is like, yeah, well, you know, what if something changes in this product and that's out of sync with this product? Like, yeah, it definitely is tricky. But I think, you know, if you're using a good authentication provider, whether it's Clerk or Auth0 or whoever, they have mechanisms in place to make sure that you always get back in sync at some point. And yeah, that, you know, we don't have a users table at Unki. We just roll it as is, and we reference everything via tenants, and that has been working really well for us.
So you've been working in this space. I mean, I see Unki as being very sort of tangentially related to Clerk. As you've worked in the space of sort of these service provider, like critical service providers to gating this deeper product, what do you think the future of this space is? And maybe this is like more broadly the sort of, I won't say back end as a service, but these like critical components as a service, like, yeah, I don't know. Where do you think the space is going?
So I think you're going to see more of these show up, whether it's like, you know, or another authentication provider, or maybe another database provider, or it's whatever it might be that's in this critical path that we're all on. I think you're going to see more of them. And the reason is because these services that are on mission critical are so hard. They're so hard to get right. And if you're scaling at any level, whether you're building a side project or you're trying to build a startup, you don't have time to get it wrong. you have time to move off of it later, right? So there is a potential that, you know, you outgrow this service that you're using, whether it's an auth provider or whoever. There is a point where you may outgrow that, and then at that point, if you're outgrowing your service provider, that means you have the team in place to actually do it right. And there's no, it's not an emergency. There's no like, oh God, I got to get off of Clerk tomorrow, because if I don't, like, the whole world's going to explode. That doesn't exist when you're using one of these, unless, you know, they're down for 7 days in a row, then sure, then it's mission critical. But if you're ready to scale off of these products, the idea of doing it yourself, I still think you're wrong if you're going to try and do it yourself, but that's fine. It becomes less mission critical. You can do it correctly, the right way, with the right people in place, with the right security measures. And then you end up, you know, taking it on your own back. But when you're scaling, you can't do that, right? If it's just two people, like if it's just me and Andre, I don't have time to figure out, like, you know, how to do organizations and invitations and all these other things that come along with building out B2B stuff. I don't have time for that. But like Clerk gave it to me and it took me 20 minutes. I'm done. I don't have to worry about this ever again. But if we roll our own, it's easy for us to kind of slowly migrate off of that and worry about it. And I think you'll see that more and more in other parts of the industry, whether it's, you know, another auth provider or another, you know, Sentry-esque open source project or something like that, where that kind of comes into play. Like all of those monitoring systems, like I think all of that stuff, you're going to see more and more of them. And a lot of them will fail because they just think, oh, I can do it better than X. And then they realize, wow, this is really complicated. And some will succeed. And I think the next 5 years are going to be very different than the last 5 years. Like, I think we've seen a real boom in them recently, but I think the next 5 years are really going to transition to this. You'll probably end up using more of those services in your next project than ever before. So the only thing you ever really worry about is business logic, not everything else.
Yeah, it's like, it's almost like the componentization of backend. Like components have become a huge thing in front end. Like I want the same thing in the back end. I want to be able to put Lego blocks together and build my application. I don't want to have to whittle my own Lego blocks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I did that for a number of years and it was horrible. Like building out like mission critical services to, like, I worked at one point for online registrations for like motor vehicles. So if you like bought a car in Pennsylvania, they could issue the tags right there. And I built some of that behind the scenes. And that was like the worst thing ever, because you're trying to like build out this service that's mission critical for dealerships and there's nobody else is doing it. So you have to build everything from scratch. There's no packages. It's like, you know, the year is 2009 where React was barely a thing and Angular was like the most popular thing. And we were building around that, and it was the worst. I have never been more excited about web dev than right now. It's just so easy to get started. It's so easy to scale, and you will see more of that in the back end, I think, in the coming years, where people realize that, hey, it works in the front end. Let's do this in the back end, and you'll get the same experience.
I think something that we're seeing, too, is like, well, there's a refocusing of, how many engineers do we actually need to build a product and make it sustainable? That's like a real question. And people are actually starting to think a lot more about the value of engineering hours and like how you scale teams, which makes like, you know, branching off and using a service a great idea. And then the landscape is just becoming so much more competitive, yep. Partially because of a consequence is that it's easier than ever to spin something up. So starting new products is, you know, probably as cheap as it's ever been. And given that we have this and folks can iterate so quickly on their core products, if you're spending a lot of time doing business infrastructure stuff and you're not iterating on your product, you know, somebody's going to swallow you whole. So that's a big driver of this overall space too.
Yeah. And I think you're seeing that already where, you know, you see these big titans of the industry that, you know, 10 years ago, it was like the gold standard. That's where you wanted to go and work. They were building the coolest stuff. Like, they're just not doing it anymore. They just don't. They're moving at like monolith that, you know, 10 years ago, they were laughing at these monoliths of like, ah, ha, ha, like it takes you so long to like release a new feature. And now they're in the same place they were 10 years ago. And so now all these smaller startups that can just move at the speed, like I think cow.com is a great example of that. Like if you look at Calendly, which is their direct competitor, like cow.com ships so much all the time. For like, if you look at their release, like it's just insane the amount of releases they do. And you look at Calendly, they're releasing like one every quarter, maybe like one big feature a quarter. And like, why do you think cow.com is so popular? Because they, like, if you need a feature, they can ship it faster than anybody else. So like, you go and ask them, and they're like, that's a great feature, we should do that. And they go and build it, like, and it's in there in like, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks. You're like, wow, okay, yeah, I'm going to use their product because they can ship this at speed. And I think, you know, that's just going to be more and more apparent as time goes on, that small startups can ship way faster.
Exciting time to be a front end or a web developer, at least.
Indeed, indeed.
Okay, with that, let's transition to tooltips. First up, this is a repo I found thanks to a former guest, Steve Manuel. This is Wasmnizer TS from Intel, and what it does is it'll take some TypeScript code. It's a subset of TypeScript. They're working to support all different language features, but you can take some TypeScript code and compile it into a Wasm module. That seems like super cool to me, and just like, you might go like, why would I want to do that? I got Node on a server somewhere. But I think this would probably provide lots of security benefits because of the sandboxing. Like, you can create a TypeScript program and run it now in any other language with something like Xtism or something that supports Wasm. So if you've been looking for something like this, this seems like the go-to repo, since it's been updated in the last 2 days and is from Intel. Exciting to see where all the Wasm stuff is going.
Yeah, Wasm seems to be really taking off recently. Like, there's been a lot more in the industry than probably like 6 months ago. It's crazy to see how much the active development is in that space.
Yeah, sandboxing is really hard. So having something that has like a solid sandboxing model is already like so much further ahead, and then having a lot of compilation targets. Yeah, I think it's only going to continue to explode. Really exciting time for that too.
Next up, we have Verticalize.
This is a kind of a weird library that I saw, which is like very, it's very creative. So it's making a pipeline-like operator just using a function or a proxy, essentially, I guess. So if you've seen the JS pipeline proposal where you can like, you know, have a function and then like pipe other functions to it, essentially that. It's just using a novel sort of like function chaining syntax or whatever. I personally would much prefer that we actually get like a proper pipelining syntax in the language, you know, instead of doing this. But this is very clever, and it's super small. It's like 200 bytes minified, so it's like basically nothing. It's a pretty novel idea.
Yeah, they use the V character there pretty well. Yeah. Really makes the eye flow down through the control flow. Next up, we have Reflect Notes. We actually talked about this a little bit on the last episode, I think.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So this is my shout out to Andreas, who first switched over before I did. I'm really bullish on this right now. Some of the features it's just absolutely insane. So right now, because we take a lot of meetings, we do a lot of stuff, like being able to essentially link your calendar and then just like have notes for every calendar invite, and like being able to sort of have that is made it really easy, and being able to search through them and have it. I'm not a huge note taker, so I don't take a large amount of notes, just because like my brain doesn't really work that way. So when I do take notes, I need to be able to find them at some point. And, you know, I've used Notion in the past, and I've used Obsidian, and I've used every other kind of, and this is the only one that's made it easy enough for me to be able to trade between devices and sync everything together and really make it easy. And having that calendar built in has just been like the like game changer for me, because I'm like, oh, sweet. I can just take a quick couple notes here, and I can share it with Andreas, and Andreas can share it with me. And it's been super worth it, and definitely highly recommended if you're looking for something that you can just do all of your note taking in.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about Reflect is they make people as like a first class entity in the system, which I really appreciate. That like people in meetings being like first class entities, which you know, for a lot of things that we do in life, it's like people and events are super important.
Yeah. And when you take like, you know, if you take two or three meetings with somebody, or you're maybe even if you're a manager and you're doing one-on-ones, like being able to have that first class entity of a person and then clicking on them and then seeing everything that you've talked about in the last, you know, three or four meetings is so useful. Yeah. When I was at Clerk, I would do that, which was, you know, all my team have their one-on-ones, and like I could look through and talk about, okay, this is what we talked about last week. How can we like close that loop and make sure we're all good there before we move on to new things? Yeah, it's so good. And definitely worth the $10 a month.
Next up in line with my last tool tip is a package called Carton, which allows you to take machine learning models from a few different types of machine learning libraries and then package them in a way that you can use them across languages really easily. So like in their docs, they show them loading up in stuff in various languages. Like they have a TypeScript API, a Rust API. And I like that it's just like a layer in between me and all the complexity of machine learning models. Like I'd love if we could move to a place where like using an ML model is just like a one line of code thing, and I don't have to think about a lot of other stuff because it's pretty hard and not very portable because everything's in Python. So I just like seeing more projects that are making it easier to use ML and stuff that just isn't Python.
Yeah, that's like one of my only reasons not to do ML stuff, really, is like any like investigation. Like when it got really popular, like for a while where it was like really booming, I like did a little Python-y and I was like, man, I don't like Python. I remember why I never did like scripting in Python. So yeah, anything that makes it like easier to use in your language of choice is definitely something I'm super interested in.
Yeah, and it seems to have some Wasm built in there. So maybe you could run this in a browser. I'm not sure how fast any ML model would run in a browser, but the fact that you can do it, still pretty cool. Next up, we have Dino Qs.
Yeah, I actually mentioned this in our last recording, but this is a new feature that Dino released. So Dino has already had a key value service, and the API for their key value service is just so nice. There's so little to it, and now they're releasing a queue service. The thing that I guess I'm pretty bullish on Dino overall, and the thing that I really, really love about these services that they're integrating is they feel like language features. They're just so intuitive. It's like not some, you know, crazy API that you're trying to wrangle or whatever. It literally feels like more of a native like JS thing or TS thing in this case. And I'm super excited about that. And I'm also, you know, super excited and hopeful that they come out with like the rest of the core set of functionality that you need to sort of like build basic services. So the KV and the queues are already like a huge step forward, you know, with some like blob storage in there. They're going to be a really compelling offering in this space. So I'm sort of excited to see that evolve.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. Next up, we have Rise, the calendar that works for you.
Yeah, this is another one of me. I promise you guys I do have some code one at the end, I promise. But yeah, Rise is really, really good. So let's say you've got like a team and you're trying to find time on your calendar, or maybe you need to meet with an external person. This allows you to essentially one block off time for like focus or whatever, so that even if your calendar gets filled up, it will like put blocks on your calendar automatically once it gets too full, so that you can actually work on, you know, doing software development or whatever you do at your job. But then on top of that, like if, for example, all three of us are a team and we need to meet with an external person or another team in the department, you can essentially give them a scheduling link and it will decide based upon that of all the three people, like what's the best times to meet. And it will basically give them like a cal.com link that they can then pick a time and then you can approve it. And then on top of that, because I work cross, you know, time zones, it has a built-in feature that tells me what time it is for my team members. So like Andreas shows up and, you know, if I go and open my Rise right now, it says it's 10:35 PM. So I know for a fact that he is probably not going to want to meet right now, but I can find a time and it will advise, you know, based upon you know, however long you set for your time limit. So there's 30, 45, and 60 at the bottom. You can select one of those and it will give you, hey, the best time tomorrow to meet would be 11 a.m. And then you can like send a request and give it with your team. Yeah, and it's just been super helpful trying to keep everything in track and trying to do this cross, you know. It's hard when you have to do mental math every time of like, oh, he's in Germany plus six. Okay, the time would be this for me. But then, oh, okay, this person's in, you know, West Coast. So now I have to do the math to add the extra, you know, 3 hours in. And then it's like a mess. So for us, it's been really great to just be able to give that and be like, here you go. You can pick a time and it will work. Any of these times will actually work for both of us. So yeah, it's been super nice. And it has a great free tier. Like the free tier is like 5 team members. And everything else is included. So you don't even have to, like, you know, buy extra stuff. Everything's just included and you can do up to 5 team members. And then once you get past that, then it costs like 16 a seat and then you just get unlimited seats. But everything is included. So, yeah, it's super great. Really, really impressed.
Yeah, that looks pretty good. We might have to look at switching this if it's free for 2 people. That sounds very nice to me.
And honestly, it's been like a breath of fresh air to be like, oh, also it's a German holiday on this day. Like, okay, cool. Like, I don't have to worry about that. Like, I can just skip that. Like, all that stuff is built in. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, living in California, it is like the second worst place in the world to be if you want to go on conference calls with people. The first worst would be Hawaii. Hawaii, you're literally never going to be able to talk to anybody. But yeah, we've had the same problem here with like trying to schedule anybody that's outside the US. It's like, I don't want to be up at 8 in the morning and Justin doesn't want to be up or super late either. So yeah, definitely a hard problem to solve. The world's a big place. Yeah. And then now for the last dev tooltip, Hanko.
So Hanko is authentication and user management, but it's specifically built right now for passkeys, which is becoming incredibly popular. And if you don't know what passkey is, it's essentially like you can use... for example, on your Mac, it allows you to sign in without actually providing any details, and it's stored securely in a keychain. So even if they get compromised or you get compromised or whoever gets compromised, there's no way for anyone to access anything. It's basically the future of how things are going to work. It's all passwordless. And yeah, so I used this recently. I was just checking it out for just like a side mess around kind of thing, because I like to just look what's going on in the industry. And it was super great. It's very similar to kind of what Clerk is doing in Auth, where it's like got elements and you just kind of drop those on. And then based upon whether passkey is enabled or not, you get like different routes. So you could just do email with an email code, or you could just log in with passkeys, or, you know, social providers like Apple, Google, etc. And it's super impressive, and it, you know, you can get up and running in minutes. Very similar style, and yeah, they just started to build out. They are open source, and it's been super interesting.
That's cool. I don't think I've logged in this way yet on any service.
This was the first time I've ever done it too. I was like, oh, passkeys, finally someone's doing it and it's like their main focus, let me try it out. And it's super interesting how it works. So when you first sign up, it will essentially send you an email code, and then immediately afterwards it will ask you, hey, do you want to use passkeys? And then you click it, and if you're on a, like an app Mac device, it will just ask you like, do you want to enable this for this device? And you just click continue, and then anytime you sign into this, you just click passkey and it'll just sign you straight in, use your biometrics. Super cool.
That's nice. Yeah, throw one password out, it's no password words now.
Yeah exactly. No need for passwords ever again. Just get rid of that. Get rid of your password managers, just use passkeys for everything.
Yeah, that'd be a nice feature.
Okay, that wraps it up for tooltips. Thanks for coming on, James. This was a fun conversation talking about backend components and what you're doing at Unkey. So good luck with that, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Had a blast. Please reach out if you ever want to chat again, or if you want a CTO, let us know, and I'll make Andreas get up early or late, early. We're either one, and we can chat again. But yeah, had a super great time.
Yeah, I just echo Andrew. Thanks for coming on. And API keys is actually something I've been thinking a little bit about. So it's something that is on the docket for implementation at Oxide. So it's like top of mind. So, you know, I'm glad you are working on it. Definitely, I'm, you know, excited to see more innovation in this space, allowing people to just focus on their products, which is cool. So best of luck to you. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.